doesn't realize that we could be heading towards World War III with the kind of comments that he's making.
Yep. Just another day.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
It is not.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM People Powered Radio in LA. Up in Oregon on 91.7 KYAQ on the Central Coast, 106.7 KSO in Cottage Grove. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on 92.9 WLRI. In Maui, Hawaii on 88.5 FM KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN 94.1, in Palenville, New York on 102.9 WLPP, in Grand Rapids, Michigan on WPRR, in New Orleans on WHIV 102.3, in Washington, D.C. on 105.5, and in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe on the internets every day on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR Revolution 99, Deprogrammed Radio, Detour Talk, and Radio Sputnik. Blanketing Planet Earth 5 days a week, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. That comment about heading towards World War III, we will talk about in a moment, but that was from the Republican chair of the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee, warning about Donald Trump and his rhetoric. There is reason to be concerned about that and about what he has to say. It's not coming from some lefty. It's not Michael Moore, let's just say, putting out that kind of rhetoric. That's Bob Corker, U.S. Senator, Republican U.S. Senator. Before we get to that, the horrific, speaking of apocalypse and the possibility of it, the horrific, devastating, and frankly, apocalyptic fast-moving wildfires out here in California, particularly in the northern part of our state, but down here in Southern California as well. Those fires continue today. We'll have details on that and much more coming up in our latest Green News Report with Desi Doyen.
Yes, it will be there.
A little bit later. But even since we have recorded our GNR earlier today, the death toll has already risen to 15, I think, was the last number that I saw.
That's the last that I saw.
In those fires.
15 dead, 150 still missing.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Not good. And no. Also not good, the fires, which the number of houses and other structures that were just completely leveled, just completely wiped out, entire neighborhoods in the worst of the fires.
I would call it incinerated. You would see entire neighborhoods just down to the foundations.
That number has increased from 1,500 to 2,000 today, according to officials. But those numbers, both the death toll and the damage, are still expected to rise. As of this afternoon, the federal government has now responded to Governor Jerry Brown's request for assistance to help battle those blazes. Brown said in a statement today that FEMA has responded promptly to California's request and that he appreciates the quick response of the president. Yesterday, Brown had declared a state of emergency in 8 different counties from Napa and Sonoma up north to Orange County down here in the south, and had requested a presidential major disaster declaration to help battle at least 18 blazes that are still burning throughout the state. So more on that and on the still desperate conditions in Puerto Rico following Hurricanes Maria and Irma in the GNR upcoming. But putting out fires apparently is one thing, even as the Trump administration seems dead set on ensuring many more of them, as well as worse and deadlier hurricanes, by continuing to gut any and all measures taken by the Obama administration to try and curb global warming and the man-made greenhouse gases that are helping to fuel our climate crisis, but creating firestorms, political ones in any event, and perhaps military ones as well, is another matter. And it seems that Donald Trump is dead set on doing that day after day, politically, in domestic affairs as well as in foreign affairs. And with his attempt to roll back any of President Obama's climate regulations, Trump also seems dead set on rolling back any of Obama's foreign policy accomplishments as well. Perhaps only because they were Obama's, not because the U.S. has anything to actually gain from doing so. In fact, in many of these cases, clearly, the U.S. may well lose in doing so. The case with Iran and Trump's vow to decertify the seven-nation agreement regarding nuclear enrichment in that country, no matter how it may hurt U.S. interests and help hardliners in Iran, Donald Trump seems to want to gut that agreement. That's just one example of that. I'll be joined by the president of one of the groups who helped shepherd that agreement through with the Obama White House and Congress momentarily to try and make sense of why it is that Donald Trump wants to scotch that agreement, despite all of his top advisors, from his Secretary of Defense to his Secretary of State to the chairman of his Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Pentagon, all saying that Iran is fully honoring their side of the agreement. And yet, Trump seems dead set on breaking the deal anyway. We'll be joined by Dr. Trita Parsi of the National Iranian American Council to discuss why that may be and what are the ramifications of doing so shortly. He argues that we could be headed toward a potential military confrontation if Trump continues down this path. That's likely just one of several such confrontations that Republican U.S. Senator Bob Corker, the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, was referring to in his remarks about touching off World War III that he gave to the New York Times over the weekend.
Sometimes I feel like he's on a reality show of some kind, you know, when he's talking about these big foreign policy issues. And, he doesn't realize that, we could be heading towards World War III with the kind of comments that he's making.
Again, that was the Republican U.S. Senator Bob Corker, chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, warning that Donald Trump could be heading this nation towards World War III with the comments that he is making. Following Donald Trump's cryptic and chilling remarks late last week before a dinner with military leaders that he gesturing to them and saying that this could represent the calm before the storm, vowing only that you'll find out what he means when he was asked what the hell he was talking about. Following that, there is continuing great concern that Trump could be planning a military confrontation with Iran or North Korea, who we already know they already have nuclear weapons. Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut says it's time to take Trump's threats seriously, as well as those from Republicans like Bob Corker. In a Twitter thread on Monday, Senator Chris Murphy said that Trump's rhetoric directed at North Korea must be taken seriously following those remarks from Corker about the possibility of Trump leading the U.S. on the path towards World War III. Murphy tweeted, "It's time to take Trump seriously as he keeps hinting over and over that he wants to go to war with North Korea. Trump's war drum rhetoric seems like over-the-top braggadocio, but why assume it's just bluster? Other bluster, for example, the Muslim ban led to action on Trump's part," Murphy tweeted. "Experts agree and are telling Trump that the window is closing. North Korea will soon have a nuclear weapon that can reach U.S. and our allies. Trump keeps intentionally cutting the legs out from underneath Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and any diplomatic path. There is purpose here, it seems," says Murphy. "The risks of surrounding himself with only military men has always been that they will only give him military solutions." Murphy says many of us have begun to hear whispers of more serious war talk in and near the White House. The calm before the storm comment from Trump sent chills, says Murphy. The timing of Corker's comments referencing possibility of World War III might not be accidental. Murphy warns, now is time, before it's too late, for Republicans and Democrats to make clear no preemptive strike against North Korea can happen without a vote by Congress. Well, while I agree that Congress ought to be making very clear their own war powers, they've essentially rolled over and given up on that when they lauded Donald Trump for attacking Syria. Not ISIS, not Al-Qaeda, but actually a sovereign nation of Syria when he attacked them and sent, what was it, 56 Tomahawk missiles over there against him. It seems like Congress has already said, hey, it's up to you, Mr. Trump. You can do whatever you want.
And remember, it's not just the Congress that lauded him. It was also the corporate media that gave him a huge bump in the polls and lots of positive coverage saying, oh, he's presidential now. That's a very strong incentive for Trump to decide that, hey, this will boost my popularity.
You bet it is. You bet it is. And Donald Trump seemed to be very proud, seemed to be very happy when he was standing at the White House with those military leaders and their wives before that dinner. Describing this as the calm before the storm. Oh, you'll find out what I mean by that. He seemed very happy, like, oh, you guys are going to love this one. We're in a very dangerous place, and I have been warning for a long time that people need to take Donald Trump more seriously. I was warning that before the election. A warning that he very well may win when everyone else was saying, oh, don't worry about it. We don't need to. He's a clown. He could never win the presidency. So I warned it then, and I've been warning it ever since. And I think there is just this sense in, I don't know if it's in D.C. or if it's in the media, that, oh, he's all bluster. No reason to take him seriously. I think we should take him very seriously. I think we should very much take him at his word. And while it's nice that finally there is some Republican in the U.S. Senate who is willing to speak out against Donald Trump, I'm talking about Bob Corker here, pretty much everyone else there is staying quiet. People who you might think would join Corker, like Lindsey Graham, who was mercilessly attacked by Trump during the primaries and even after he was elected. People like Lindsey Graham, he was out playing golf with Donald Trump on, what was it, Monday?
Yeah, he tweeted about how much he enjoyed it.
How much he enjoyed it. What a great golfer the president was. So I don't think they take him seriously at all there. I'm hoping Bob Corker can make some headway, but I don't think they take him seriously at all. Meantime, he's stoking these wars, particularly with North Korea, suggesting that the only thing that can stop a madman like Kim Jong-un is military action. Well, Donald Trump's own CIA seems to disagree. Zachary Cohen over at CNN reported late last week, between the ruthless executions of his own senior officers, bombastic threats of nuclear annihilation, and defiant missile tests, it may be easy to disagree with Donald Trump's recent assessment that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is a, quote, madman who is on a suicide mission for himself. But top officials from the CIA said last week that Kim's actions are not those of a maniacal provocateur, but a, quote, rational actor who is motivated by clear long-term goals that revolve around ensuring regime survival. Yes, it's easy to refer to Kim as, he's crazy. He's going to attack the U.S. We got to stop him. He's going to send nuclear missiles over here. He must be stopped. Well, the CIA... says that is not the case. Yong Suk Lee, the deputy assistant director of the CIA's Korea Mission Center, talked about the escalating tensions between North Korea and the U.S. last week. He said there's a clarity of purpose in what Kim Jong-un has done. Waking up one morning and deciding he wants to nuke Los Angeles, he said, is not something Kim is likely to do. He wants to rule for a long time and die peacefully in his own bed. The last person who wants a conflict on the peninsula is actually Kim Jong-un, Lee said. The mixed messages coming from the Trump administration continue, however, to raise questions about the U.S. approach to North Korea. Trump has repeatedly undercut comments made by his own top officials and publicly engaged in a war of words with Kim that has devolved into insults and name-calling, only raising fears of an eventual military conflict. Ambassador Joseph Detrani, who previously served at the Department of State as the special envoy for six-party talks with North Korea, said, when North Korea, when they hear what's coming from the president, I think it resonates with them. Trump said last week that the U.S. will do what we must to prevent further threats from North Korea. We will do what we must to prevent that from happening, and it will be done if necessary. Believe me, he said, we can't allow this dictatorship to threaten our nation or our allies with unimaginable loss of life. Over the weekend, Trump tweeted that only one thing will work against North Korea. But while Trump continues to publicly paint Kim as an irrational dictator, CIA officials said the intelligence community views North Korea's leaders' actions through a very different lens. While Kim may not want a war with the U.S., he does view the strategy of perpetuating a confrontational relationship as a key to maintaining his grip on power. That, according to Lee of the CIA, and Michael Collins, Deputy Assistant Director of the East Asia and Pacific Mission Center at the CIA. So Donald Trump seems to very much be playing precisely into Kim Jong-un's hands. The way that Kim Jong-un hangs on to power here is by perpetuating this constant confrontational relationship with the U.S. North Korea is a political organism that thrives on confrontation, Lee said. Kim remains unlikely to intentionally start a war with the U.S. or its allies, they said, because that would almost certainly result in Kim's own destruction, that according to Collins and Lee. But both CIA officials, according to CNN, said they anticipate tensions with North Korea will continue, raising the risk of a miscalculation from both sides. And while the prospect of a North Korean preemptive strike on the U.S. or one of its allies remains unlikely, Detrani admitted that there is a sense that North Korea is unpredictable if put into a corner. So all of this information, Trump's own CIA says that Kim is not a threat unless provoked, unless put into a corner, unless backed into a corner. Donald Trump seems dead set on backing Kim Jong-un into a corner, despite the fact that should a war break out, you know, we have, what is it, I think, 25,000 U.S. troops in South Korea and in Japan, if I'm not mistaken.
And in Guam nearby.
But they don't even have to hit a target down in, you know, use a long-range missile to hit Guam. They've got missiles set up, good to go, that can reach South Korea, Japan.
Within minutes.
Immediately, yeah. And yet, this corner that, his own CIA people are saying don't put Kim into, that seems to be the corner that Donald Trump seems dead set on putting North Korea into at this point. And while an unpredictable leader with nuclear weapons, be it Kim Jong-un or Donald Trump at this point, while that is unsettling, one wonders why the hell Trump would then continue to undermine a treaty with another country that has effectively been working, by all accounts, to keep them from getting nuclear weapons in an even more volatile part of the world. Yes, that in the Middle East. We've got a treaty there. It is working. It has prevented Iran from getting any closer to being able to create a nuclear weapons, which could reach Israel or any number, which could light off any number of confrontations in the Middle East. Why the hell would he do that? What the hell is Donald Trump thinking in his reported plan now to try and kill the anti-nuclear agreement with Iran? That story is next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away. All right, welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Recently, the chairman of Donald Trump's military chiefs of staff at the Pentagon, General Joseph Dunford, told the U.S. Senate that, yes, Iran was, in fact, complying with their side of the hard-fought 2015 anti-nuclear deal struck between them, the U.S., Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany. Donald Trump's own Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, concurred with Dunford's assessment that Iran was honoring the agreement. Shortly thereafter, so did Donald Trump's Defense Secretary, General James Mattis. The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, tasked with overseeing compliance of the agreement by Iran to ensure that they are not enriching uranium for a nuclear weapons program, has now verified 8 times since January of 2016 that Iran is solidly adhering to the nuclear accord. Other international bodies such as the EU have all also concurred. Even Donald Trump himself has twice since his inauguration as president certified Iran's compliance with the agreement. And yet, with all of that in recent days and with another congressionally imposed deadline for the administration to officially state whether or not Iran is still in compliance, that deadline is coming up on October 15. With all of that, Trump has suggested that he plans to decertify the deal anyway, or at least inform Congress that he does not believe Iran is in compliance, and allow Congress to decide whether or not to reimpose the harsh economic sanctions that were lifted in exchange for Iran mothballing thousands of nuclear centrifuges that the U.S. and other parties to the treaty had determined could have been used for creating nuclear weapons. Why would Trump do that? What possible gains would be in it for the U.S., particularly if, as many experts seem to believe, the other parties to the agreement would not join the U.S. in reimposing sanctions against Iran, whose government moderates have only grown in strength, a lot, by the way, against the ruling religious conservatives in the two-year aftermath since the agreement was signed. Dr. Trita Parsi of the National Iranian American Council, who worked with President Obama in helping to craft the deal, warns today that scrapping the agreement could, quote, put the U.S. and Iran on a collision course that could result in outright conflict, theoretically even military conflict. He also warns, in a piece published by the New York Review of Books today, that pulling out of the deal will do little more than help bolster Iran's conservative hardliners, including its supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei, who originally opposed the nuclear agreement because he reportedly believed, after years of failed deals and attempted deals, that the U.S. could simply not be trusted. And the hardliners also feared that warming relations with the U.S., as that deal might do, would lead to a rise in power by moderates against the conservatives in Iran. Well, that rise in moderate power has been borne out, with substantial gains in the Iranian parliament now firmly in the hands of moderate President Hassan Rouhani's coalition, as well as a resounding victory for Rouhani himself earlier this year in the presidential election, dealing yet another blow to the hardline clergy. But as the Ayatollah's claim that the U.S. cannot be trusted, as to that, Donald Trump seems ready to hand him what Parsi describes as a gift to the hardliners in attempting to decertify the agreement. Why is that possibly in the best interest of the U.S.? Here to explain all of this, what it means, why it's even happening, and how Donald Trump's rhetoric is being heard in Tehran is Dr. Trita Parsi. He's a Middle East foreign policy expert and the founder and president of the National Iranian American Council, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization dedicated to strengthening the voice of Iranian Americans and promoting greater understanding between the American and Iranian people. He's the author of several books on these issues, including his latest, Losing an Enemy: Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy, which details, among other things, Dr. Parsi's experiences as an advisor to the Obama White House during the negotiations for the controversial Iranian nuke deal. Dr. Parsi was born in Iran himself. He moved with his family at the age of 4 to Sweden in order to escape political repression. His father was jailed by both the Shah and the Ayatollah Khomeini. He later relocated to the U.S., where he received a Ph.D. in foreign relations from Johns Hopkins School for Advanced International Studies, and I'm delighted that he's able to join us today. Dr. Trita Parsi, welcome to the broadcast, sir.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you here. As you describe in your book, you yourself worked on this very agreement. Very quickly, before we get into some of these concerns I mentioned, what role did you play in that process?
So I want to make sure that your presentation doesn't overstate my involvement, but as the president of the National Iranian-American Council, my organization was called in by the Obama administration's on numerous occasions, frankly, throughout these negotiations to advise, and also later on when it came to the fight in Congress, in which it was an effort to try to stop the deal. We played a pretty important role in securing congressional support for this deal in order to make sure that it wouldn't get killed. And this gave me a front seat privilege of being able to see what was going on, what the calculations was, because throughout all of this, I also had great access to the Iranian side with numerous interviews with the Iranian foreign minister, who was their lead negotiator.
And after the agreement was struck, Congress tried to, seemingly for oversight purposes, demand that the president certify that Iran is in compliance every 3 months, if I understand it. And that was, of course, when President Obama was in the White House. And that if the president finds them not in compliance, Congress can then vote to leave the agreement by reimposing the previous sanctions regime against Iran, as I understand it. Do I understand essentially how that is supposed to work?
Yes, that is correct. If I could add some detail.
Yeah.
The president can decertify, but not only if he believes that Iran is in violation of the deal, which in this case it is not. Mm-hmm. Iran is living up to the deal. But he could also decertify simply because he doesn't want to certify, or because he can say, look, I don't believe it's in the U.S.'s interest any longer to continue to waive sanctions. And that is what has been signaled he will do. He will not be able to go and make the case that the Iranians are in violation of the deal, because his own Secretary of Defense says that they're in compliance.
Right.
The Secretary of State says they're in compliance. The head of the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff says that they're in compliance. So does the U.S. intelligence community, and so does the IEA. The only thing he can say is that, well, I don't think it's in the U.S.'s interest to continue to waive sanctions. And then they'll kick it off to Congress. And then the question is what Congress will do.
And so that is, so there is legitimate legal grounds, at least within what Congress requires the president to do. There's legitimate legal grounds for him to decertify the agreement just because he feels like it. There doesn't need to be any actual breach of the agreement in order for him to decertify.
There does not. He can simply say that in the totality of U.S.-Iran relations, I don't believe that it's any longer in the interest of the United States to continue to waive sanctions. He'll send it to Congress. Congress will then have to make a decision whether to reimpose sanctions or not. And if they do, then the U.S. is in clear violation of the deal. And that will very likely bring about a do-or-die moment for the nuclear deal.
And I have seen, I want to talk about that do-or-die moment, but I've seen the argument in any event that the U.S. themselves have already broken the deal with the imposition of new sanctions recently signed by the president just a few weeks ago. Is that true, or in any event, is that how Iran sees it?
I don't personally believe that the imposition of the sanctions recently have been a violation of the deal.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think it is a much stronger argument to say that by going to the G20 and discouraging them from trading with Iran, Trump is in clear violation of Article 29 of the agreement, which says that no country should stand in the way of what is now legitimate trade between Iran and the outside world. You can't lift sanctions as an incentive for the deal and then go and encourage countries not to trade with Iran.
Mm.
That's what this article essentially said.
Uh-huh.
And that's exactly what Trump went and did at the G20 meeting. He went there and he lobbied countries not to trade with Iran.
So they themselves, Iran themselves at this point, would have the right to pull out of the deal and claim that because the U.S. Broke the agreement.
And there are voices in Iran who's made that case, but fortunately thus far the Iranians have refrained from further escalating this. They have complained about the U.S. being in violation, but they haven't done anything beyond that.
As best as you can explain it, and I know that it might not be easy, but what is the other side here? What's the president's side of this, correctly or incorrectly? What is his actual complaint with this seven-party treaty? What would he have liked to have seen? I mean, he said many times it was the worst deal ever struck. It's an embarrassment to the U.S. What is his actual complaint, Dr. Parsi?
It really is not clear what the actual complaint is, because when the Iranians are living up to the deal, what is it really that he's complaining about? If he's complaining that, you know, the Iranians are keeping X amount of centrifuges, etc., well, he's in clear minority. Everyone else signed on to this deal. The U.S. was the lead negotiating force behind this, and it signed it. More than anything else, to be completely frank, this seems to be in line with almost everything else Trump has done since he took office, which is he just simply opposes anything that has Obama's signature on it, whether it's the Affordable Care Act, whether it is the Iran deal. And there seems to be an obsession on his end to undo it for that simple reason, because in his own administration, his Secretary of State tells him, don't decertify. His Secretary of Defense tells him, don't decertify. His Chairman of the Chiefs Joint of Staff says, don't decertify. So what is it that Trump, with his brilliant real estate mind, manages to see as a flaw with his deal that no one else seems to be able to identify?
Well, that kind of that was sort of my next question based on that is, if there is an actual diplomatic path, whatever it is. I mean, I've heard him complain that, oh, after the deal expires, they'll be able to continue enriching uranium again, that the deal itself doesn't even speak to Iran's other military programs, like its ballistic missile program and so forth. So my question was going to be, is there an actual diplomatic path with Iran to answer to these complaints? But it sounds like if there's not really legitimate complaints, there's not really a diplomatic path to work them out with the country. Am I right about that?
Well, here's the thing. This is a negotiation. So if you want to get more, you have to give more. The United States could potentially have gotten more in terms of restricting the program a little bit more and, you know, a little bit longer duration.
Mm-hmm.
But in return, it would have been forced to give much more, probably on the sanctions front. And the more sanctions it was offering the Iranians, the stronger the opposition to the deal would become in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
So bottom line is, if you want to get a better deal, yeah, offer a better deal. Provide something else to the Iranians that would get them to agree to make further restrictions. But in order for Trump to have any chance of being able to negotiate addendums to the deal or additional deals, he needs to first prove himself trustworthy by adhering and living up to the obligations of the current deal. He's not doing that. Mm. There's no reason for anyone in the international community to really trust him, because he's reneged on the Paris Agreement. He is pushing NATO around. He's reneged on this agreement. Why would you negotiate with Trump? What is it that gives you the confidence that he has the capacity of upholding his promises? That's the problem here. One could make the argument that there could be better deals that could be gotten. But in order to get those deals, you need to have the credibility of being a good and fair and trustworthy negotiator. Trump does not have that reputation anywhere.
And that all sort of parallels my conversation yesterday on this show with John Nichols, who basically of The Nation, who basically said, well, you know, when you have these sort of negotiations, being tough, threatening military options. We were talking about North Korea mostly at the time, but that goes along, that goes hand in hand with diplomatic options. You're trying to force them to the table. He doesn't seem to have a plan, really, to get to the table with Iran, no matter how much of a fit he throws here. There doesn't seem to be a diplomatic path to overcome these issues peacefully. Am I right in that observation?
There is a path. He's just doing everything he can to make sure that path more or less is eliminated.
Okay.
I mean, Obama managed to create that path by looking at the Iranians, recognizing he needed to be careful with the language that he used. He needed to be tough, but at the same time make clear that he's willing to compromise, that he's willing to offer something. What Trump is doing is ensuring that no one really finds any value in any negotiation. And if part of his assumption appears to be that he believes that the United States has a much stronger hand than it does. The Obama administration negotiated really, really hard, but they recognized they had to give compromises. They had to accept that Iran is going to continue to enrich uranium. They had to accept that at the end of the 15-year period of this deal, the Iranians are going to have a nuclear program that is no different from any other non-proliferation treaty party, because there was no other option. The United States simply is not in a position of power to impose on the Iranians a stricter variation. The United States could get a better deal in that sense if it was willing to offer more. But offering carrots was also very costly politically, mm-hmm. and that's part of the reason why more wasn't offered.
Dr. Parsi, I want to play this clip from Republican U.S. Senator Bob Corker over the weekend. He's the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He's speaking to the New York Times here about his concern as to how the rest of the world feels when Donald Trump makes pronouncements, as he did last week with military leaders, that this is the calm before the storm, or when tweeting various threats against other nations like North Korea or Iran. Here's Corker, and then I want to get your thoughts on it.
I don't think he understands that the messages that he sends out, especially when you take into account they're being received in other languages around the world,
yeah.
what that does. I know he's hurt in several instances. He's hurt us as it relates to negotiations that were underway by tweeting things out. And I don't think he appreciates that when the President of the United States speaks and says the things that he does, the impact that it has around the world, especially in the region that he's addressing. And so, yeah, I mean, that's it's concerning to me.
That was Senator Bob Corker, Republican from Tennessee, saying that Trump doesn't understand the impact of his statements, the way they are heard around the world. Dr. Tridiparsi, even before Trump officially decertifies the nuclear agreement with Iran, as he was reported to be doing, what is the effect of his rhetoric alone on these matters? How is this sort of thing, whether it's, you know, threats that Iran is not in compliance or has claimed that this is the calm before the storm, how is that sort of thing heard in Iran?
Well, I think the Iranians perceive this as Trump being incapable of, frankly, handling these issues, that he thinks that he can simply bully his way into a better situation. And I think it reveals a tremendous amount of naivete on Trump's behalf, because that's not the way international relations really work. I mean, it may be a tremendously clever strategy if you're a real estate developer in Manhattan. You may have to play these games, and perhaps you can bully your subcontractors into giving you a better price. But the countries in the UN Security Council, France, Germany, England, Russia, China, they're not subcontractors of the United States, nor is Iran. This is not a strategy that has any chance of success on the international stage. The only question is, how much damage will it incur on the United States before Trump stops doing what he's doing right now?
And that's what I'm wondering, is how much damage it might have done already. You write today in the New York Review of Books that many in the U.S. are not appreciating just how much the accord has in fact bolstered the moderates in Tehran. Has that rising moderate movement yet been damaged by just the rhetoric of this president, or even by the Republicans in Congress, who have long been calling to scrap this particular deal?
It has been heard. You can see that in the polls right now. There's a lot of disappointment amongst the public that the deal has not delivered as much as they hoped for as a result of Trump scaring away investors. But I don't think we've seen even the beginning of the damage. That what we will see after decertification. And at that point, the big scary thing that could happen is that if this then leads to a scenario in which the reformists in Iran start losing political ground, start losing elections, because then we'll potentially be back in an Ahmadinejad type of a situation. And I don't know why anyone would like to return back to that type of a scenario.
How do you see this playing out? If, as reported, he plans to say to not certify this, to then send it to Congress, to have them decide how this moves forward, what is your sense in Congress, how they will react? Will they, in fact, also vote to decertify this agreement? And if so, then what?
So the first question is that there is actually resistance in Congress against reimposing, snapping back to sanctions, which is quite unusual. Congress otherwise loves to impose sanctions on Iran. But it's a very easy thing to do because it has Congress is sufficiently removed from the consequences of its actions, so it's a pretty cost-free thing to do. This time around, that's not the case. If they snap back sanctions, Congress will have killed the deal. And as a result, it's a consequential vote on par with the vote to authorize George Bush to use military force against Iraq in 2002. And a lot of members of Congress deeply regret that vote, and some of them have paid a very political high price for that vote. So you're starting to see a lot of members of Congress starting to have second thoughts. They don't want Trump to push this issue onto them because they don't want to own the disaster that will follow if they snap back sanctions. So there's a chance that Congress actually will not snap back sanctions, at least not entirely. They may go for a third option, but that option may also, unfortunately, be sufficient to kill the deal. It may just not kill it as quickly or as directly.
What would that
third? So for many in Congress, it's not about whether you save the deal or not. You just don't want to be responsible for what happens. So if you can kill the deal, but avoid responsibility for killing the deal, unfortunately, a lot of members of Congress would opt for that option.
Like they spent years saying, well, we need to kill Obamacare, and then when they had the ability to actually do it, maybe we don't want to do it after all. Maybe we're not so sure.
It's been so costly for them to be so disconnected from the consequences of their rhetoric, the consequences of their votes. This time around, that's not the case. They will own this. And that has created a situation in which almost all Democrats in the Senate are going to oppose any reimposition of sanctions or any the strict reimposition of sanctions. Mm-hmm. And there may also be a decent chance that several Republicans will jump ship. I mean, Trump has already declared war on several Republicans in the Senate, including Senator Corker, with his insulting tweets. So I don't think there is much sense of a party loyalty any longer. We've already seen that several senators, senior senators, broke with Trump on health care and on other issues as well. So you may end up having a situation in which a strict snapping back of sanctions actually will not pass Congress. Then the question is, will they do something else or will they just not do anything? Mm-hmm. Then if they don't do anything, then we have a scenario in which, okay, Trump decertified, but there was no sanctions reimposed. So technically, the U.S. is not in violation of the deal, and it's not necessarily going to kill the deal. But it will still create a significant amount of uncertainty. What will happen in January when he's supposed to certify again? Mm. Will he just skip certifying because he just decertified once and simply won't go back to it? What will international business think? Will they go into the Iranian market, or will they believe that, you know, this is just too risky? If international business ends up not going into the Iranian market and the Iranians won't get the financial benefit, the economic benefit of being in compliance, then political dynamics in Iran are going to more or less inevitably lead to a scenario in which the Iranians will stop being in compliance.
Yeah, and that's not good.
That's not good at all, because that so it opens up so many different pathways for the deal to fall apart. What we need to see is not Trump certifying or decertifying, but Congress not pulling the trigger. We need to see the United States live up to its promises, affirmatively commit itself to this deal, which is working, that is delivering, and stop messing around with it, because it's not gaining anything. It's only creating more uncertainty, which then leads to more instability, and then potentially a collapse of the deal that can bring the United States back onto a path towards war with Iran.
Yeah, that's what I want to. I know I got to let you go here, but very quickly before you do, you write that if this goes the way it seems to be going right now, and I guess it would have to do with Congress not recertifying the deal, but who knows when you're dealing with Donald Trump, that we could be back into a potential military conflict with Iran. What's the pathway towards that that you see that could possibly happen?
In 2012 and 2013, before there was a breakthrough in the negotiations, the risk of a military confrontation between the United States and Iran was very, very significant.
Mm-hmm.
The risk of the Israelis taking military action was also very significant. That very negative scenario was eliminated by this deal. If the deal collapses and the Iranians restart their program and start moving closer and closer towards having a nuclear weapons option or a breakout of no more than a couple of weeks, then that very negative scenario comes back onto the table. Mm. It's as simple as that.
And then we get into Bob Corker's World War III scenario, which he seems to be trying to warn us about.
Yeah, because all of this is happening while he's also picking a fight with North Korea.
Yeah, like we don't have enough trouble already. Dr. Trita Parsi, really helpful speaking with you today. Greatly appreciate you joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. You can find his work at as the president of the National Iranian American Council at niacouncil.org and on Twitter, where you should follow him, at T. Parsi. That's the letter T, P-A-R-S-I. Doctor, thank you again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you don't mind if we bother you in the future.
Please do.
All right.
Thank you.
Okie dokie. Well, you feel any better, Des, after talking to, hearing the explanation for what he's doing?
No, not at all.
I don't get it. I don't even see how this helps Donald Trump. Unless he's under the impression that, oh, you know what? Wartime presidents are popular. If I can start a war somewhere, whether it's North Korea, whether it's Iran, somehow that will make people love me.
Well, it would make sense within what we sort of understand about whatever is going on inside Trump's gigantic, massive ego. The really big problem that I see beyond the direct impacts of him decertifying the deal is the long-term impact that this has on U.S. credibility in any kind of negotiations. Just like Dr. Parsi said, why would you ever negotiate with the United States ever again?
Well, exactly. Why would what incentive does Kim Jong-un have to even come to the table? Well, obviously, Donald Trump doesn't care whether Kim Jong-un comes to the table.
Right.
He keeps telling his own Secretary of State, hey, don't bother negotiating with this guy. There's only one thing that we can do, which apparently is bomb them, and yes, as Bob Corker said, set off World War III.
And not just that, but even if we did get a sane president again,
mm-hmm.
hopefully we still can, that in the future, countries can say, well, why should I trust you, sane president?
Yep.
Because the next president could be insane and could also scotch any negotiations.
Underscoring exactly what the hardliners have been saying, or the hardliners in Iran who tried to stop the deal in the first place, we are just feeding into their hands. It's insane. All right, quick break and more insanity in the Green News Report with Desi Doyen straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. Can't stop the world, no matter how much we'd like to try at this point. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Desi Doyen, we recorded this morning our Green News Report, but already since then, the death toll in the fires in Northern and Southern California have increased from, I think we had it as 10. Now it's up to 15 with more than 180 missing.
Yes,
at this
since
point.
We started, it's now 180 on the missing list.
And more than 2,000 houses or structures damaged. But in any event, let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
This is my neighborhood in flames. Completely in flames.
Fast-moving, deadly wildfires sweep across Northern California wine country.
Harvey, Irma, and Maria could make 2017 one of the top years for weather disasters.
2017 on pace to shatter weather disaster record. 2017 also breaks a record for Atlantic hurricanes, and it ain't over yet. Plus,
the White House argues that the Obama-era regulations have been burdensome to the economy and American workers.
Trump's EPA moves to repeal Obama's landmark clean power plan.
Great timing. All of those stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
You know, regulatory power should not be used by any regulatory body to pick winners and losers.
Unless the winners are the fossil fuel industry, who get $20 billion in tax breaks and subsidies every year. Am I right, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt? This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I think many of us were breathing a sigh of relief after Hurricane Nate began to break up, only to see these horrific, devastating fires now out here in Northern California.
Yes, as we go to air, in Northern California's wine country, at least 10 people are now confirmed dead. 50 are missing in extremely fast-moving, heat- and wind-driven wildfires that have forced the evacuations of more than 20,000 people, including two hospitals. California's fire chief announced Monday that at least 1,500 structures have been destroyed. He said that was a conservative estimate. The wine country fires are among 14 large wildfires now burning in California.
And they are just exploding across Northern California and some down here in Southern California, wiping out homes overnight. Just horrendous.
And as you mentioned, Hurricane Nate made landfall on the Mississippi coast over the weekend as a Category 1 after killing at least 28 people in Central America. 2017 is now the most active Atlantic hurricane season in the modern record. For the first time since the 1890s, the Atlantic Basin has generated 8 consecutive storms that developed into hurricanes. And hurricane season isn't over until November 30th. In Puerto Rico, Governor Ricardo Rossello has asked Congress for additional financial assistance, warning that Hurricane Maria's catastrophic damage has crashed Puerto Rico's economy, deepening the humanitarian crisis. Distribution of aid remains the biggest hurdle 3 weeks after the storm, but there is some positive news. Governor Rossello confirmed he is in talks with Tesla CEO Elon Musk over Musk's proposal to rebuild Puerto Rico's electric grid as a proof of concept for a large-scale renewable energy system with battery storage.
With clean, renewable energy across the entire island, wouldn't that be fantastic? So I'm sure the Trump administration will get in the way and put a stop to that.
On Friday, NOAA announced that 2017 is on track to be a record year for billion-dollar weather disasters. Since January, the U.S. has already experienced 15 extreme weather disasters costing more than $1 billion each. That matches the number of disasters in 2011 and is second only to 2016. On average, there used to be only 5 or 6.
The year ain't over yet.
But even as the U.S. faces a record year for extreme weather, the Trump administration is rolling back another major tool for fighting climate change, taking the first formal step to repeal President Obama's landmark Clean Power Plan. That's the first ever regulations to limit the carbon emissions from U.S. power plants that cause dangerous global warming. The Clean Power Plan is key to reducing the U.S. contribution to climate change and is crucial to the U.S. meeting its international pledge to reduce emissions under the U.N. Paris Climate Accord. And it also convinced China to join as well. But in remarks in Kentucky coal country on Monday, Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt claimed the EPA overstepped its authority.
You know, regulatory power should not be used by any regulatory body to pick winners and losers. The past administration was unapologetic. They were using every bit of power, every bit of authority to use the EPA to pick winners and losers in how we generate electricity in this country.
Pruitt's claim is wildly contradictory. It comes on the heels of a proposal by the Department of Energy to intervene in electricity markets with new subsidies to prop up the ailing coal and nuclear industries, which have proven unable to compete against cheaper wind, solar, and natural gas. And most states are already on track to meet the plan's emissions targets at a lower cost than previously projected. The fossil fuel industry praised Pruitt's move. States and environmental groups have vowed to use every tool to challenge the repeal in court. Now, the repeal is only the first step in a long process that could drag on for years. Crucial time lost in the fight against climate change.
Crucial time lost, but apparently no hypocrisy lost. not by this administration. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget, you can download our reports anytime via Stitcher, TuneIn, or iTunes. Find us, follow us, and share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. And speaking of things that the Trump administration seems to be doing to harm themselves, again, why would you kill the Clean Power Plan? You want to do it, obviously, to help your coal friends, but you say, Desi Doyen, we're already...
Yeah, power plants are already halfway. Yeah. States are already halfway toward meeting the targets on schedule of the Clean Power Plan. And I think it's worth emphasizing the Clean Power Plan never came into effect. It was stayed by the Supreme Court before Scalia died.
And yet...
We're doing it anyway.
We're doing it anyway. We've decreased emissions. We've met, what, halfway to our goal, our Paris Climate Agreement goal at this point?
Yes.
Like
well, we're halfway to the Clean Power Plan goal. I mean, there's a lot more that still has to be done, but it's kind of remarkable that they're making this effort, which is just, it's stupid.
Which is going to harm the U.S., harm the globe, harm our interests, harm our people, make them sick, cost us money, cost us more and more money. Billions and billions as we have more fires, more hurricanes.
Self-inflicted wound.
This administration seems to excel at that, don't they? All right, got to get out. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen. Thank you very much. And to my guest today, Dr. Trita Parsi of the National Iranian American Council. And to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It is greatly appreciated as ever. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. You can follow me on the Facebook and the Twitters at The Brad Blog. I hope you'll find us, follow us, and share us worldwide there as well. Or you can drop me email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. Finally, as ever, my thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves to discuss the stuff that matters. At least as long as we can. Bradblog.com/donate. Thank you. All right. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.